All right, this next presenter is a good friend of mine, and I tell you what, I invite him to speak at just about every event that I'm a part of, not only because he is a wonderful teacher, he's living most of the philosophy and practical application of the stuff we're talking about, but he is so on point when it comes to the message of freedom. I really appreciate him. He doesn't need much of an introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Jack Spirko, the Survival Podcast.
Can you hear me? All right, guys, I want to start out with something. I want to get you guys excited. I mean, that music was pretty good, AC/DC, come on. But, you know, we're pretty much through almost a whole day. You've been tired. One of my biggest mentors in permaculture is a guy named Jeff Lawton. Anybody ever hear him? If you take one of his PDCs, he'll clap you in for every new segment or whatever. I'm going to clap you in. I'm going to say one, two, three, and you clap, and that wakes you up. But I have a special way of clapping people in. Long time ago, I knew I wanted to sell permaculture to the world, and I needed to be tricky. And I knew there was nothing trickier than a baby duck. Nothing trickier than a baby duck. So I created a little YouTube series called Duck Chronicles. I call myself, and these shirts are available for sale at tspswag.com, a redneck hippie duck farmer. And we came up with a tagline for it, Duck the System. It's a triple entendre. So I'm going to go one, two, three, and you're going to clap and say, duck the system in unison. And if you don't do it, I'm going to leave. I'm not going to present. I mean it. All right, ready? One, two, three. One, two, three. There we go. All right. All right, let me get my deck back up. They done turned it off on me. Y'all leave this alone. I got this. All right. So, title of my talk today is Food Security is the First Security. Has anybody here ever been to a part of the world where you didn't really feel comfortable walking down a street unless there's a couple guys with guns taking care of you? Anybody been to a place like that? Few people. Was there food security there? Food security is the first security. How many people here ascribe to the non-aggression principle John talked about? A lot of hands. So you're not going to ever use force against anybody unless they use force against you. You've committed to that. How long would you watch your child or grandchild starve before that might change in your heart? Food security is the first security. Now imagine people that have not made that commitment. How long do you think they're going to watch their children starve? We have some issues. I want to help us cover those today, but I also want to remember, why are we here? Anybody does literally anything. And the government has its hand out and wants its share. What I'm going to share with you today is largely not taxable by the law, by the code. But even some of it that might be would be pretty hard to tax, including making improvements to your land through things like gardens, trees, bushes, shrubs, and vines. Tax assessors don't understand that stuff. You put an addition on your home, you did something, they want their cut. The other thing is we're here because we're supposed to be working together. So please do me a favor. Make connections. Write down each other's names, contact information, and write something about the person like he's a jerk. Those inside the fold know what that's about, right? But, you know, what they're looking to learn, what they can teach. That way, when you look at their contact information 5 days from now, you'll remember who they are. Write down something about them. Please make those connections. It's one of the most valuable things you can do while you're here. I also want to talk about, what does it mean to eat really great? And I'm trying to be fair to both vegans, vegetarians, and the carnivores, and I tend toward more of the carnivore side. I got something for everybody today. But I would assert, and everything on this picture right here was either grown on my property or made by my buddy, the Booze Whisperer. I didn't grow any oranges in Texas, and I didn't make the liquor, allegedly. But you go to any high-end restaurant, and you put this food on a menu, and nobody's going to complain about it. And every bit of that was grown on my property. Some of it was foraged off my property, which is a whopping 3 acres. And about half the food we eat is either wild or endemically wild because we made it so. Lamb's quarters, those are nasturtium blossoms, fennel fronds, wild garlic. There's little purple flowers in there are from a plant called spiderwort. Now, I want to eat this way. It's expensive to eat that way. I don't want to spend the money, so I grow my own food. And what I want to do for you guys today, when you come to a conference like this, if I'm speaking, I want you to be inspired, but I also want you to go home and say, there's one or two things that crazy duck farmer said that I know I can do. So I'm going to go through some basics on gardening is what to grow instead of how to do it. And they're all crops that I figured out grow where I live, which everything dies there, right? So you know you can count on them. They're all kind of targeted toward our region here in this part of Texas. So if you came from a long way away, you might say, well, I can grow other things. Great, that's nice. This stuff will work. But I want you to know you can do it. I'm going to talk about some small livestock and some other things. But also, we can eat grape. But why am I doing this topic? Why am I coming at it from the concept of food security? Do you know what our number one export is? Topsoil. The United States of America exports more topsoil by the ton than any other product that we export. You get no money for it. We don't do it on purpose. That's debatable. It goes down our rivers and streams into our oceans and creates giant dead zones. Very definition of unsustainable is exporting your topsoil, your most valuable asset to grow food. If you're a carnivore, what does your food eat? What grows your food's food? We are all in this together when it comes to topsoil. Declining fertility? Unsustainable. You cannot have your fertility going down and be sustainable or regenerative. Declining biodiversity, declining health of our ecosystems and our society. As goes a nation's soil's health, so goes the health of the nation. Realize that. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, the COVIDs, that's what I call it, and who died. Well, if you look at it, a lot of the people that became more susceptible to whatever the disease is, however you want to define it, their health was in decline. There's things like selenium that are really important to the body. You know how quickly that's being depleted from our soils? It's incredibly important. But what about a 12-to-1 energy ratio to the negative? Does that sound like something that can't be sustained? If you're putting in 12 units for every one you get out, does that sound like a non-winning game? That's food production in America. It takes 12 million energy units measured by caloric units to produce 1 million energy units of food in calorie. Gas, oil, diesel. 12 million to 1. 12 million to 1 million. You know why I used 1 million? It's what the average American eats a year, about 1 million calories. That's based on 2,800 calories a day. That's too much. That's why we're all fat. But that's what it takes. 12 million to 1. Something must be done. And the big thing is there's no excuse for any of it. We have solutions to every single one of these problems. What we're going to cover today, I'm going to start off with some calorie and nutrition crops. Again, these are things you can grow that if you kill them, you really need to work on your technique. These are the most resilient things that I've grown in the last 10 years on my little rocky cliff in North Central Texas. We're going to cover small livestock, just a short bit of it, and we're going to talk about fertility of the soil. And in the end, I'm going to show you what that looks like when you put it into practice. And I know we got some vegans in our family here. That's great. Meat trigger warning. There are two slides that will show you meat, not animals hanging or anything like that. Just meat like you'd see in a store, sort of, except it's much better. And I'm just telling you now so you can't get upset with me, and I'll tell you when it's coming. Calorie crops for southern climates. These are crops that if you grow them, you can grow a significant portion of your calories. And these particular ones, I have found to be almost indestructible from pest and disease, even before you fully tune your property. When you're just getting started and you are still trying to build soil and you're susceptible to pest and disease. Squash, winter squash specifically is a calorie crop. Anything in the family Cucurbita muscheta. My favorite one is Trumbuscino zucchini. That's me there, and that's a Trumbuscino zucchini. That's a little one. They get a lot bigger than that. And everything above the bulb is flesh. There's no seeds in it. It's all edible, 100%. You can even eat the peeling if you want. At this point, it'll taste just like summer zucchini. They have to turn orange before they're storable long-term. You let them do that on the vine. I was supposed to bring one. I forgot to bring it. I have some that are sitting in my office on the floor. They've been there since I harvested them in October. I've done nothing with them. They're perfectly fine to eat. And what you'll find is the most evil, satanic squash pest is what? Does anybody know? Squash vine borer? Yeah, this is the honey badger squash. It doesn't care. It just doesn't care, right? Sweet potato, if you live in a southern climate and you're trying to grow regular potato, you'll find a very, very short growing window and you'll fight blight. Sweet potato will outproduce it. You can grow it all year long. I primarily feed the greens to our to my own family and to my livestock, and we eat a little bit of the tubers every year. But if you want to build caloric yield, it's huge. Jerusalem artichoke, any and all. First year I grew Jerusalem artichoke, brand new bed, just getting started. Somebody gave me two of them. I cut them into four pieces each, stuck them in a 4x10-foot bed. I got five-gallon buckets of yield. Excellent crop. Beans, specifically, you want carbohydrates. You want shelling beans. Scarlet Runner, most honey badger bean you can grow in this climate is Scarlet Runner bean. Turnips and beets, that's your winter crop for carbohydrates here. I've been able to grow, I usually grow them as cover crops personally or for the animals, but I've been able to grow them through every winter except the bad one, right? The one from 2 years ago. But there was something in that winter that I put out as a cover crop that's also a calorie crop, and it lived through it. Who here knows the winter I'm talking about, right? You were here for it? Yeah, all my local people. There's a 68,000-acre lake about 10 miles from my house. Now, I live near Fort Worth, Texas. It froze solid. People walked on it. I don't think that was a good idea, but they did it. And this winter pea, which is called Blaze Winter Pea, lived. It knocked it back a little bit. It came back. It produced amazing through that year. By the way, with your peas, you can eat the pea. When it's not yet mature, you can eat the pea pod. You can eat the pea tendrils, and you can eat the pea leaves. Use the whole plant. And cowpea. Do you guys know that it was one of the true survival crops for the southern states in the Civil War? When the Union began advancing into the South, they started burning the fields. Starve out your enemy, they'll surrender. It works. Time-proven warfare. They never burned the cowpea fields because they didn't know it was food. It's a regenerative crop. It fixes nitrogen. I grow it mostly for my animals. I grow it right to my food forest. I just throw feed out every year. I want to move into other plants that I grow. These are plants that I consider more for enhancing wherever you get the bulk of your calories. Things that make your food more enjoyable, that you eat great, like that picture I showed you. This picture here, these are called python snake beans. They're not really a bean. They're actually a gourd. They come. This particular variety comes from somewhere in northern India or Pakistan, they think, because we're going so back on the ancestral food that we're not really sure where these originally came from. These have been cultivated for a very long time. Americans don't know much about them. They taste sort of like cucumber and green bean. You eat it raw, tastes more like cucumber. You cook it, it tastes like the best green bean you ever ate. I cut some of these up and made them for my students this fall. You would have thought I threw down lobster and filet mignon. Even Ken Berry tore this plant up. Mr. Carnivore himself. His exact words are, that's damn good. Really easy to grow. If you grow them to maturity, they get about five times that big. They never get tough. You can always eat the outside. The outside will start to turn orange. You'll cut that off. It gets kind of nasty, like soft. But the inside of them, if you let them mature, goes to a red pulp. Each little red pulp thing, you pop the seed out to save your seed, and that pulp can be used like tomato paste. And that's how it's used, but where it's grown natively. I grow a lot of beans. I do not mature them into a calorie crop. I grow more like, you know, you think of string beans, but I grow Asian long beans, Chinese red noodle, favorite bean. You know why? I don't see really well. By the way, if you're here and you're trying to talk to me and you're standing over here and you think I'm a jerk, well, I am a jerk, but I probably just don't see you. My field of vision goes from about here to here. That's it. And so the red bean stands out in the wall of green. So I see them before it's too late. You can grow any of those though. And you can probably end up saving seed and replanting it four or five times a season. It produces that fast. And you can find the ones that are best adapted to your property really, really quick. Peppers, I grow them all. If you can't grow peppers in Texas, something's wrong with your soil. Bad. Bad wrong. Tomatoes. Who here is from Texas and has trouble growing tomatoes? Who here from Texas and grows tomatoes with no trouble? Not many people either. Okay. If you have problems with tomatoes and you get the thing called blight, that's where your tomato plant starts to die from the bottom up. Here's your tip. When you're starting your plants, throw three aspirin tablets in the cup that you started that plant in. You can do that and you're in pretty good shape. But when you plant it, throw three aspirin tablets along with your compost and what have you in the hole. And then once a month, take three aspirin tablets, poke them in the ground around your tomato plant, water them in like they're fertilizer spikes. What I had been doing for the last 9 years, planting my tomatoes early, picking them till about July, getting tired of the blight, yanking them out and growing something else. This year, I grew tomatoes till they froze to the ground. And all I did to change that was add that aspirin. It knocks that blight back. But I grow mostly cherry tomatoes. If you have problems with tomatoes popping, getting cracks, things like that in this climate, and you probably will, use things like Matt's Wild Cherry, Sweet 100 Cherry, and Texas Wild Cherry. Those are going to be your go-to super easy tomatoes to grow here. If you want a bigger tomato, celebrity is about the most disease-resistant thing we have. Eggplant. Who here hates eggplant? Hates it. Just it's the spawn of... No, you're growing the wrong eggplant. If you think eggplant, you think that big, giant thing you see in the supermarket, you got to put salt on that and bled it out. And otherwise, it has this kind of like ashtray taste to it. Try Asian eggplants like Ping Tong. One of the most productive things I've ever grown in my life. And it tastes like whatever you flavor it with. So if you don't like eggplant, you haven't flavored it with the right stuff. It also dehydrates very well. It's a great storage crop. And herbs and greens, grow them all. I probably shouldn't have to say that, but if I didn't, people are like, why don't you grow herbs? Now, here's my meat warning. I told you it's coming. I want to talk about small livestock. And I want to talk about building fertility and how small livestock add to that. Who here, though, owns less than 5 acres? Less. It's quite a few people, right? Except for the last one, any of these things you could probably grow on just about any size lot, depending on how creative you are. I have them ranked top to bottom here, quail, chickens, ducks, muscovies, rabbits, sheep. That's not on what I think's best. That's on how much food do you want to buy in versus what they can glean from your land or you can provide for them. The most productive thing you can do for meat and or eggs are quail. I knew a gentleman had 2 stacks of quail in his one-car garage in Michigan that was producing over 20,000 eggs a year and 2,000 meat birds a year. That's not quite the way I would do it. If you look at the picture and the color of that meat there, these birds were actually pastured and tractored. Now, the reason I think they're so valuable from a regenerative standpoint, being able to be self-sufficient, is a quail goes from the day it hatches from an egg to about that size for harvest in 6 weeks, not doing anything special. 7 weeks, it'll start laying. Chicken will take you 22 weeks to start laying. And unless you're doing like the Franken chickens or whatever, it's going to take good 12, 14 weeks to be harvestable as meat. And I harvested all of what you're looking at there with a pair of kitchen shears. That's 11 birds. I timed myself to the point where I went outside and started working and came inside was about 20 minutes, and I was done. And I believe in using everything, so it's not in here, but we had the backbones. Those were for stock, livers, hearts, and the whole birds. But you're going to have to buy them feed. They're the bird you're going to have to feed the most. Chickens, I won't say a lot about that. I do want to tell you this. Anybody here know who Gordon Ramsay is? Very famous British chef. I was listening to him talk one time, and he was talking about a chicken that he had gotten, some special chicken, a breast chicken. He said it was the Rolls Royce of chickens. Then I learned from some YouTubers that there is now American breast chickens, which are just French breast chickens that we somehow stole from the French and got into our country. We have a whole Telegram community called the American Breast Chicken Group. I'm going to give you a page at the end where you can go find all my information. You'll be able to find that. But you might want to write that one down. It's a thriving, growing community where people, because we can ship eggs, are exchanging genetics and doing a lot of great work with these chickens. But chickens, a little bit more that you can provide food from your land or from waste streams. Then we move on to ducks. Duck farmer, love the duck. Best egg you will ever eat. Big thing on eggs. Who here has like an egg sensitivity or whatever, but maybe you ate a like quail egg or a duck egg and it went away? Probably has a lot to do with either the way you're raising it or the way your farmer's raising it. What do we put in livestock feed, all livestock feed, for protein? Anybody know? Soy, including organic. So you buy organic eggs, you're eating soy. What you think about eating soy for yourself, what do you think happens? You take soy, which is high in isoflavones, which are basically estrogen, and you harvest the ovum of an animal from a female that you're dosing with soy every day. You got an estrogen bomb. That's a big problem with commercial eggs. You get around it that way. Muscovies. Who knows what a Muscovy duck is? Muscovy ducks, kind of like a duck, kind of like a goose. I'm always doing this with their head and hissing. They make no real sound. This is good for your backyard, suburban yards. You can grow them on nothing but grass if you have good pasture. You do not need to feed them at all. I feed because that way they don't leave. Yeah. And you can train ducks and Muscovies to go to bed at night. Just look up all ducks go to bed. I started that. Even a lot of people are doing it now. Then would be rabbits. You can feed rabbits with a bag, with a mulching lawnmower with a bag on it, a bagger. That's really all you need to feed rabbits. I recommend you do some other things. If you don't know who Nick Ferguson is, write his name down. Look him up. He's on my expert council. His big thing is fodder trees, hybrid poplar, hybrid mulberry, and hybrid willow. With those three trees, you can feed rabbits, you can feed sheep, you can feed cattle. But you can definitely feed rabbits. But your grass doesn't really grow well in certain times of year. So go to YouTube and look up mini bale maker. And with some plywood and some basic skills, you can make a little mini baler and bale grass. And you can feed rabbits with nothing but what you get from your land, especially if you add fodder trees to it. I have some good friends, Nick being one of them, another guy named John Willis. Anybody know who John Willis is? SOE, Tactical Gear, yeah. They both have livestock guardian dogs for all their stock. They buy no dog food. They raise rabbits so inexpensively, they feed their dogs rabbits. I'm not saying you should do that. I'm just saying that tells you what the cost of production can be. And last, sheep. Why sheep? Who here has less than 5 acres, less than 10 acres, right? It's kind of difficult to do cattle the right way until you get some real acreage. Anybody here ever process a cow or be part of the process? Would you call it work? Is it work? It's work, yeah? Yeah. A sheep is about exactly, a sheep or a lamb, about the same size as a deer or a big deer. This little knife here, I can process a white-tailed deer with nothing but this knife. I'd be happier if I had a gambrel, which is the thing to hang the animal up after it's been expatched, and a hacksaw. But I can do it with nothing but that knife. You did a cow. Could you do a cow with just, no. No, you're in for a day's labor, right? So I recommend that you look at sheep. Greg Judy is the guy to look up. And look up, God, what's his name now? Justin Rhodes. Justin Rhodes, Greg Judy. Justin went through about an hour of Greg's operation. You'll probably learn more about what to do to raise sheep effectively for lambs. And he raises all hair sheep, no wool sheep, than a lot of people that have been doing it a long time. Greg gives away everything. I met Greg first back in 2013. He's got the heart of a servant. He gives away every single bit of knowledge he has, and he refuses to charge for any of it. He's an amazing man. I want to ask you another question. If you know what this is, because you were around when I posted the picture, don't say it. Don't cheat the other kids. What do you think that is? It's a piece of meat, obviously. Where do you think it came from? What animal? Anybody know? No answers? Everybody afraid? Does it look like pork? Maybe like pork shoulder for you hunters that hunt feral hogs? That is a quarter of the back of a turkey. A broad-breasted bronze turkey. The easiest meat you will ever produce, the most efficient feed utilization you will ever have is that particular breed of turkey. I kept 3 from a batch of 12 I raised. I sold the other 9, and I got 75 pounds of meat. I don't mean carcass weight. I mean boned off meat from 3 turkeys. Half a breast would be between 7 and 9 pounds. One breast cutlass, 7 to 9. It was like a brisket. That is the most efficient feed utilization I know of. But you get none of what I'm talking about without fertility. And I hear all types of talk about fertility, but I'm a redneck duck farmer. I like to make things simple, and I like to break things down to easy-to-remember points. You know how you deal with the fertility issue? Build fertility. Who here bought a piece of land, decided to grow your own food, and the first year it was really, really hard? Has that happened to anybody? A few hands, yeah. You know why? Because your land probably wasn't under any kind of a management practice. So you first had to build fertility. because it wasn't there. But then you also have to do something else. It's a part people lose sight of. You have to hold it. It's not just about preventing erosion. It's about preventing leaching of nutrient. You have to build and hold, and then you have to continuously increase. Now you're regenerative and take away any of those, because you don't got to, if you don't build, you don't go anywhere. But build, hold, increase. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about my compost method. Who here likes turning compost? You are sick people. Something wrong with you. It's work. This is my compost method. It's a modified version of something called Johnson Su bioreactors. If you look to the back, you see a little red hut. And just to the side of that red hut, there's a little pile. That's the leavings of the last time this was done. There's a pit there. I feed all my kitchen scraps to my birds in that pit all year long. There's also a pond behind that fence, and I grow a highly illegal plant called water hyacinth in it. No reason it should be, but it is. Everything we eat eats water hyacinth. It grows like crazy. And all I do is stand with a pitchfork on the other side of that fence so the ducks can't get in the pond, and I just pitch it over the fence and the ducks eat it. I do that all year, and I do what's deep litter method in the duck coop, duck and chicken coop, which means I put down a layer of straw, and the ducks go in there, and they sleep in there, and they do their business at night, and it starts to smell. So then I put down a layer of wood chips, and it starts, and every couple, 3 weeks, I add another layer all season long till it ends up about a foot and a half deep at the end of the year. We clean it out once. We make three of these. We put down a layer from the coop, and then we sprinkle stuff from that pit, and then a layer from the coop, and then we sprinkle stuff from that pit. That's just cheap goat fence, 3 foot high, circle about 4 foot, because that's how big I wanted them to be. And then those pipes, they're put down in through the compost. Every layer, you soak it like crazy. If you know what Johnson Su does and you say he's leaving stuff out, that's what I do. I simplify. I figured out how to do this and do less work and get mostly the same result, because I don't have time to be out here turning compost or doing some of the things that Johnson Su do. Once this is set up and it kind of starts to cook, you can throw a compost thermometer in it. Couple days, it'll be 140 degrees. It'll peak about 160. It'll never go over, which is great. It'll kind of form. You can then pull those pipes out. They don't have to stay there. It's actually good to pull the pipes out. You get better airflow through it. And then you just keep it wet. I take the little $8 round green sprinklers from like Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart, set one on top of each one. I adjust them with a splitting valve with a little throttle on it where you can control how much pressure is. So all three of them go off, one $10 mechanical timer. I go out in the morning, let the birds off. I turn that timer to a minute. That's all I do. Johnson Su does drip irrigation and timers. I don't have time for that. I'm a redneck. I don't know how to do all that. The one thing I did do this year differently is I wrapped it in weed blocker on the outside, because when I made this, the outside inch didn't compost. So we'll add that one thing. I took everything out. That was the only thing I think I needed to add to fix it. Compost that comes out of this. It is like nothing you have ever seen before in your life. You can pull it out. It's crumbly when it's kind of dry. You can dunk your hand into water, so completely submerge it, totally saturate it. It'll form a ball like clay, but it'll still crumble apart. I've never seen anything like it. And the results in my plants, you get a plant starts to look a little bit sick. You get a ball of it. Dig a hole by the roots, pop it in there, and in a day it starts to turn around. I don't know exactly what's going on. I'm not sure. I've had some people look at it under microscope, and they, you know, soil scientist types, people have taken Dr. Ingham's course, and all they've said is whatever you do, keep doing that. I've never seen compost when it's hot flush fungus out the side. This does that. It'll be 160 degrees in the center, and you'll have mushrooms popping out the top and the sides of it. I don't know where they came from, because I didn't put any mushrooms in there at that point. What does Johnson Su do when it's completed and it's ready to basically go to the next level? It's the heat process is done, and that your heat comes down to where your compost thermometer says about 90 degrees or lower. Puts earthworms in it. Who here has tried to do a worm bin in Texas and had them all killed by fire ants? Yeah, me too. There's Satan spawned the fire ant, right? So all I do is, you know those holes that the pipes were in? I throw mushroom spawn in them and fill them up with straw. And then the whole thing infuses with fungus. It takes about 3 months. I never turn it, not one time. Not one time. And after that, I start using it, and I just pull from the top. I really started learning about biochar in the last couple of weeks. And I had students come out, and we built three of those before I was done learning about biochar. I should have put biochar in there because of what I'm about to tell you next. Biochar is the future of agriculture. If you care about carbon in the atmosphere, it is the future of getting carbon out of the atmosphere. And if you've heard bad things about biochar, we're going to cut down all the trees. There are more waste streams to make biochar out of. We 14 times what we could possibly need. Every time you drive past a brush pile, it could be biochar. Every time you eat pistachios and throw away the shells, it could have been biochar. If you use a living Christmas tree and you throw it away at the end of the year, it could have been biochar. You trim your trees, that could be biochar. I have a tremendous number of trees on my property. I trim every year. All of that becomes biochar with a simple little kiln. Very, very easy to do. You break it up. But I was taught, and this is part of why I never got into biochar, you got to charge it up with nutrients, man, or it'll leach nutrients from your soil. It's not what it is. It's not what it is at all. You have to make it habitable. Biochar does nothing for the fertility of your soil directly. It's inert carbon, but it locks up for over 1,000 years. It doesn't get released. If you put organic matter in your soil, it will continue to break down, and it eventually releases carbon back out to a large degree. Biochar will be there when your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren are around. It'll still be there, but it needs to be habitable. We need to lower the pH because it's about 8, not because it'll jack up your soil. We need to do that because the microbes don't want to live in it with a pH of 8. And we need to make it not hydrophobic. Hydrophobic means it repels water. You want it to pull water in. Once that's broken, a pound of biochar will hold 7 pounds of water. Say that again. A pound of biochar will absorb and hold and slowly release 7 pounds of water, almost a gallon. So if you put 100 pounds of biochar in your garden, maybe your irrigation will be a little bit less demanding of you. Yeah. Well, all you have to do to get everything super sweet with biochar is break it up in little bitty pieces. You know how you do that? Steel makes this leaf blower, big old awesome leaf blower. It's got a bag on it. You turn it from blow to suck, right? Anybody know the movie? She's gone from suck to blow. You either know her or you think I'm a pervert. It's a movie. It's funny. It really is. Trust me. So you switch it to suck, and the biochar is so fragile, when it goes through the impeller, it breaks up into about 1 to 10 centimeter size, to 1 to 10 millimeter size, which is the perfect size. And the bag is a super filter, so you don't get a bunch of dust. And you dump it into whatever container you want, and you put it in your compost. One thing with biochar, you can eat it. Totally non-toxic, and maybe you should. I definitely am going to start adding it to some of my livestock feed. It absorbs toxins. Our government says we shouldn't feed it to livestock if the livestock is going to be used to produce products for people. But what is, do you know, anybody want to guess my rule with the government? Whatever they say, do the opposite, right? California, of all places, has actually made an exception to this for livestock products in their state, and they've got great results with reduction in a lot of problems in their livestock. But there's one place it doesn't belong, in your lungs. So I haven't gone on to the side of the NIH and Fauci, but when you're working with biochar, wear a highly effective dust mask because that dust does not belong in your lungs. But once you get it into the compost, it'll start to lock up, absorb water. It won't be a problem anymore. And the reason I started digging deeper into biochar, anybody here ever read the book 1491, America Before Columbus? Anybody read that book? Read that book, 1491, America Before Columbus. Terra Preta. This is how ancient societies in Amazonia created soil that still grows fertile today, even though it hasn't even been taken care of in hundreds of years. They did low temperature burns. They made pits. They threw all the woody material in the pit. They set it on fire. And then they threw green material on top of it, choked the fire out, and then spread it out. They built it at about 1 centimeter a year on mass scale. And there's places where it's 2 meters deep. Anybody want to do the math and say how many years they had to continuously cultivate to get that? be 100 years. Metric system's easy, even though we resist it. And we can combine this with silvopasture, which is where we grow trees and we intergraze. Remember those fodder trees? We can do fodder trees and silvopasture systems. And then we can take the trimmings. When you take fodder from the tree to feed your animals, you end up taking material that's too big for the animal. There's your biochar. Now you grow more healthy grass, you grow more healthy cattle or sheep or any other pastured animal, and you have a closed-loop system. That's just one application of that. And that brings me to something. When I mentioned biochar, I mentioned there's some people, especially in the permaculture movement, really upset about this. They want you to believe that pristine wilderness, especially like the Amazon, that's the way, you don't touch anything. This is something we have still an arrogance in us today, even though we don't realize it. The reason we ever believed that is the original colonizers couldn't see that these people that lived here knew something they didn't. They built this incredible system where soil is so fragile, and they were able to have hundreds of thousands of people living in places that we don't even think can support life. And the latest research says the whole Amazon, or at least a large part of it, was likely designed and planted by man's hand. We do not have to be a destructive force. We are not apart from the wilderness. We are not apart from nature. We are not native to this planet. I am as native to this planet as an elephant or a deer or an elk or a buffalo or an apple or an orange or a blade of grass. And so are you. We can co-create. And that's about the application of technique versus tactic. A biochar would be a piece of a technique. Composting is a technique. The tactic is the way that you apply it to the landscape, the way that you create with it. That's the important part. Anything can be used as an excuse for evil. Anything can be used poorly. Be very careful when you latch on to an idea, like I'm about to show you, like a swale. The way you implement it, the tactical application of the technique is what's important. Back in 2013, we moved on to the piece of land you're looking at now. This is about a 3/4 acre piece of it. All in, it's about 3 acres. We call this the Eastern Forest. And those are some swales that we had put in a few days before this picture was taken. So this is late fall 2014. We put swales in. We got a great big rain. We did a cover crop seed. We had not planted any trees yet, because I honestly didn't have it in the budget at the time to put the trees in. Just cover crop, get the swales in. We did the trees that spring of 2015. We used a lot of the stuff that I would talk to you about today. We were very tactical in our implementation of technique. The place that I live, 5 inches of soil, solid rock. I mean like a parking lot. It is harsh. This, every time I look at this picture, it hits me emotionally. Not this one, the next one. And I did this. I actually had these two pictures made into a single picture. They didn't display well in a slide. I did this so whenever I get disgusted, whenever I have a bad year, whenever I have something go wrong, I remember why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's 3.5 years. 3.5 years. That's working with nature. That was working with the ducks. People said the swales would fill up with mosquitoes. Very temporarily, because the water infiltrates. 1 year we did get a ton of rain and the mosquitoes stuck around, and I threw BT dunks in there and they all died, and the ducks had a field day and ate them all. But usually what happens, they go in there, they make their little wigglers, the swale dries up. You know what the body of a mosquito wiggler primarily is? Phosphorus. Phosphorus. The swales spread the duck manure. They spread the water. They killed the erosion. This land was grazed by goats, by people that wanted to make it go. They made what was bad really bad. We turned it around in 4 years. One more time. 3.5 years, 4 inches of dirt, solid limestone rock conglomerate. Looks like concrete. It's basically nature's concrete. Where you're sitting right now 50 million years ago, over top of your head was the Great Inland Sea. That's why we have so much oil and gas. Where I live, that reef formation is only 4 inches under the soil. Just a few years later. If I can do that there, you can do that anywhere. And I want to talk a little bit here at the end. This is a URL you can use. thesurvivalpodcast.com/greater4. Tons of extra resources for you. How to do all the stuff I talked about. It's all free. But I want to talk to you about what got me to a point. I'll bring it back. Don't worry. What got me to a point where I realized I could do this. I want you to find your heroes. If it's not in permaculture, I don't care. Whatever it is you want to do, I want you to find your heroes. And I want you to look at what they do, and I want you to realize why a person should be a hero. It's not because they play sports ball. It's not because they're a hero that doesn't wear a cape because your government told you that. It's because they do something you want to do in such a way that you look at it and say, I can do that shit. I can do that. Anybody ever remember the old movie 8 Seconds about Lane Frost, the bull rider? There's a song from that movie by Billy Dean. And he said, the best thing our heroes do is they point to the best of us all and say, if I can, you can too. When I started my podcast in 2008, I thought permaculture was you planted trees instead of corn. That's all it was. I didn't know anything. By 2014, when we were putting those swales in, I was standing on a stage next to my heroes, speaking next to Jeff Lawton, Joel Salatin, Mark Shepard, Alan Savory. I'm standing here in front of you today only because what those people did wasn't impossible. It wasn't like watching some guy make an immaculate reception. And I love Franco Harris. I'm an old school Steelers fan. But I would never be able to do what those people did. We look at that. That is the edge of human performance. The stuff we're talking about here, it is the center of human destiny. This is our planet. We're part of it. They don't get to make these decisions for us. And we can sit here and talk about Satan Schwab and the WEF and all of that, and we can very, very quickly fall into using it as an excuse for inaction. Go home and do something. If it's not this, I don't care. We need tech people. We need crypto people. We need legal people. We need finance people. We need a complete new community. And you are it. There is no second tier coming. You are it. Go make something happen.
All right, Mr. Spierko, give it up for Jack. Yeah.
Are you sick of being told you will own nothing and be happy?
Are you sick of being told how to live your life by the mainstream media?
Exactly what people think.
And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Are you exhausted with the truth community focusing only on the problems?
Are you ready to do something about it?
Let's take action together. Join the Freedom Cell Network in January 2023 as we return with the Greater Reset for co-creation.
The Greater Reset is a 5-day in-person and online gathering where solutions-focused speakers and organizations share practical steps for individual and collective liberation.
This year, we'll even hear experiences from real communities on the ground across multiple continents.
The Greater Reset 4 will focus on activating 5 focus areas over 5 days.
January 18th, liberate your mind, body, and soul.
January 19th, permaculture and food independence.
January 20th, agorism and parallel networks.
January 21st, take back our tech.
January 22nd, building free and conscious communities.
This is our time to co-create the world we want for 2030 and beyond.
Join us as we lay the foundation for the next stage of a free humanity.
Join us from January 18th to the 22nd, 2023, as we gather online, in person in Central Texas and Morelia, Mexico.
Join us for the Greater Reset 4. Co-creation.
View the full speakers list and organize your local activation hub at thegreaterreset.org.